Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm the desiccated husk of what used to be Matt Jarendaisy. Welcome back,
friends and lovers. Doctors. And we have just been subjected
to 74 minutes of unbelievable edgelord garbage, the likes of which I've never seen in all my years. It is rank. Holy shit. I feel like I've seen this is stuff that I've never even brought up on the podcast. I've seen some like really trash, like shit bucket outhouse cinema. Some like, you know, not even like your fucking Friend Requests or your Slendermans or, you know, stuff that makes it to theaters that's just drivel. I mean, like movies that are just an ordeal to sit through by design. That
like,
are, you know,
like Aliens 5, Strange Monsters.
Things 5, Strange Monsters.
Excuse me. I couldn't remember the
name. And that movie is at least, I mean, like movies that are that badly made, but also hostile towards you.
Have no charm.
And have no sense of humor. Yes. And I've sat through movies like that and enjoyed many of them, if you can call it that, derived something of value from some of them. So believe me when I say, because I worry that I'm going to come off sounding like terribly puritanical, and I'm not. I've seen some wild ass shit in my time. I feel like I just watched a screaming hillbilly fuck a dead possum for 74 straight minutes for 74 uninterrupted minutes with its fucking carcass flapping around, and he's like spitting and crying blood, and his.
Or maybe it's not quite dead.
Yeah.
Like it's
it wasn't
in pain.
When he started. Yeah, right, exactly. And I'm next. And the hillbilly is shitting, just explosively shitting all over his own legs. It was not a pleasant viewing experience. I didn't care for this one.
So the film in question, after we've just expelled 150 seconds of straight bile, is Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2022, the Netflix release, the very recent Netflix release. As you can probably tell from our level of contempt, we both feel it is easily the worst film in this sprawling franchise. Matt has seen every single one.
I have. It's funny. Our last requel that I more or less loathe. Maybe that's where the possum imagery came from. a Scream, the new Scream. I've only seen the first Scream. However, I am a connoisseur of the TCMs. I've seen all of them. I've seen fucking 1 through 4. I've seen Texas Chainsaw 3D. I've seen both of the like Michael Bay era reboot prequel things.
Saw Leatherface.
Leatherface, yes.
From 2013. Yeah, no, that's 3D. 2017 or 18.
Yeah, the French filmmaking duo who did Inside.
Right. I have seen all but 3 and 4, so I am nearly there. We are both at least relatively expert in the franchise. Yeah, this is far. I did not think it was going to get worse, could get worse, than the one with Alexandra Daddario in it. And yet, here we are.
Well,
The
one with
this
Daddario.
Wait. This is as much worse than that as, like, VHS Viral is than Citizen Kane.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
It's just any superlative you want to throw out there.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Alexandra Daddario one is a good example of, like, Slenderman Friend Request caliber drivel that's like, okay, this is the worst movie in theaters this week, this month, maybe even this year, but it's not
Hall of Fame
cosmologically
trash.
Bad. It's not, like, different planet, subterranean. It's not abyssal the way that this movie is. I really am having a hard time. There's a scene in it, and we'll get to it when we fucking damn well get to it, that genuinely like made my skin go cold, and I still haven't recovered. I feel like a little bit physically unwell, and not like because of the carnage turned my stomach. I mean something was stirred inside of me, or possibly just euthanized. I don't know which, but there's been
so that it could be euthanized while conscious.
Yeah, right. There's been a spiritual amputation has taken place here today, and I really do feel like
yeah, you're like the kids in His Dark Materials who've had their demons taken away
when their Digimon shadow things get yanked away from them. Yeah.
Yes.
I only ever read the first one. I've been meaning to catch up with the rest of those Golden Compass books.
Yes. So, wow. We better get to the fucking synopsis. Let's get this shit train rolling.
I took notes on my phone. We watched this on Netflix. It's a Netflix joint, and so I had my phone out the whole time, or half the time, and you know, incredulously penning my Letterboxd screed in between horrified glances at the screen, like a fucking war correspondent, just breathlessly keeping up with the bedlam.
One other thing I want to point out before we get this rolling. For the first half of this movie,
it was normal bad.
It was normal bad. Like,
normal
even
bad,
not as
normal
bad
stupid.
As 2013. It was just like, it was just kind of there. It was making no impression. So somehow, all of this spite and bile that is being spewed from us is on the basis of 37 minutes of movie.
That's true. It sure as shit didn't feel like it. No, the reason I bring up that I'm fiddling with my phone as we speak, there was a moment, I think it's just because the microphone was in the way, I held my phone up to my face and it didn't recognize my face. And I thought, oh no.
This film has broken my face.
This movie has actually remade me in its image. I'm just a sick puppet. Now, I am actually just the desiccated husk of what used to be Matt Gerandese. Okay, we open with a kind of listless recap of the events of the original film, courtesy of a sound-alike for the guy that they got to do the opening crawl back in 74. Five youths, you know, that kind of thing. Sally Hardesty and her invalid brother Franklin. And then the camera pulls out, and we realize that we're watching a wall-mounted TV in a gas station or a convenience store kind of situation. And it's an episode of some sleazy daytime unsolved murders show. And Leatherface is still at large, wouldn't you know. We're shown the most useless composite sketch in the history of motion pictures because it's him wearing his leather face. It's like, how are you gonna identify him based on that? This is in fact brought up shortly when our protagonist, whose name escapes me, goes up to the counter to pay for her items, one of which is a novelty chainsaw corkscrew tchotchke kind of thing.
Yeah, incidentally, this is Elsie Fisher from 8th grade, and yes. I just gotta say, Elsie, fire your agent and then try and team up with Bo Burnham again, because you do another movie like this, you're never gonna work again. You gotta get your fucking career back on track, because you started real strong.
I watch a bunch of old Siskel and Ebert, right? And they're very easily scandalized and they get incensed about slasher movies, which seem fairly toothless nowadays, you know, milquetoast, but they would really get exercised about it kind of the way I'm doing now. And Siskel in particular, I didn't know this until relatively recently, he like kind of, is it Betsy Palmer who plays Jason Voorhees' mother in the first movie? I think that's the actress's name. He like directed the readers of the Chicago Tribune, his readers, to like send her hate mail, basically, or to like complain to her about her role in, you know, corrupting the youth of the nation. And I was always like, you know, I like Gene Siskel, but I was put off by that, needless to say. This is the first time I've felt that level of vitriol towards creative people behind and in front of the camera. Because when you said, like, fire her agent, I thought, into the sun, you know, like, dispatch hitmen to, you know, to send someone to his house to break his thumbs, you know, really teach him a lesson he won't forget. I don't mean any of that, I hasten to add, but you know, I suddenly,
if the FBI's listening.
Yeah, right. Well, I obviously, when I held my phone up to my face just now, it was Gene Siskel's face staring down at the screen for a moment. I really am a thoroughly changed man. So, new protagonist, eighth grade, goes up to the counter in the gas station and says, how come they never caught him? Oh, and the gas station attendant clerk cashier fella says that Sally Hardesty, the lone survivor of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre from back in 73, she became a Texas Ranger and she looked for Leatherface for years. And eighth grade says, well how, and she found him, right? And he like looks at her like she's stupid and says, you know, he wore a mask. How are you supposed to? He's, like, he's got a very distinctive build.
Right.
You know, I mean, that composite sketch was worse than useless, but, you know, from head to toe, he's still fairly recognizable. So that's idiotic. But again, just normal stupid for now. I'm not going to harp on about everything that happens in the movie's first 30-odd minutes because its last 40-odd minutes are beyond belief. So we meet a team of Zoomer gentrifiers, basically, is what they are. They're coming to this ghost town in the heart of Texas to revitalize it and put their own spin on it. One of them wants to open an art gallery, a bunch of other stuff that nobody gives a shit about outside of Austin in the Lone Star State.
Right.
They run afoul of this guy at the gas station who they then run into again when they arrive at the ghost town. One of the girls makes fun of him for, you know, being an open carry dipshit, and he says some pretty pointed stuff about how they, you know, we got feral hogs around here.
Only one way to handle an invasive species, wink, you know.
Yeah.
Like Zoomer gentrifiers from the north.
Yeah,
for
multicultural
example.
Invaders. which is what they are. And
polyglot abyss.
Yeah, thank you. That's one of my favorite, which is to say least favorite, Lovecraftisms. That's from Horror at Red Hook. And that story is great because it gives you quite accidentally a window into the mind of a bigot that just compounds the horror of what the story purports to be about. But it's, you know, it's just about like a cop who works in the slums and thinks that the people he's supposed to serve and protect are literally less than human. And this and that to a modern sensibility, or, you know, a less horrifying 1920s sensibility, someone more progressive than old Howard Phillips, that you know, just obviously amplifies the cosmic horror of it all tenfold. Polyglot abyss indeed. So they make it to the ghost town. Open carry dipshit is there. He's doing some work renovating one of the buildings. He's a contractor that they
He's
hired.
Their contractor.
Yeah, and they didn't recognize him. Only spoken to him over the phone, I guess. There's a Confederate flag on the edifice of one of the buildings, and it looks, you know, ratty, like it's been hanging in the sun for 30, 40 years. And one of the guys who's kind of the brains of this whole operation is a black dude. He wants it taken down immediately because potential buyers are coming in soon in a fucking party bus. We don't know that yet, but we find out soon enough. And if they see even a whiff of the Confederacy, if they catch the faintest little frisson of Confederacy,
they're gonna bounce,
which is funny because there's a Confederate statue behind them. I assume it's a Confederate general on horseback in I guess what passes for town square, that goes totally uncommented on despite being featured prominently in multiple shots.
Well, yeah, but it's not Robert E. Lee, so people don't just jump right to the conclusion.
I guess
one of the marginally more obscure generals, I suppose.
So they go into the building with the flag on its exterior, and there's an elderly woman wheeling around an oxygen tank who comes out to harangue them. You know, this is my house. And they try to kind of gently, kind of brusquely explain to her that it's not her property anymore.
The bank seized by the bank.
Yeah, right. And she's not all there. And they call the cops on her. She's got a ward, or maybe it's her son. It's Leatherface.
Yeah. Well, the building used to be an orphanage.
Yeah, and we see a photo on the wall, like, you know, class of 75, right. And there's a hulking brute in the background with his face scratched out.
Yeah,
and
She used to run the orphanage.
Very distinctive build.
Yeah, right. And they're the only ones left in there now. So, yeah, the cops get called. In the commotion, she has a heart attack, and they throw her into the police van because that's the closest thing they have to an ambulance, and they're going to try and get her to a hospital.
Yeah, that was one of two lines in this scene and also in the entire movie that I thought was a little bit clever, when the one sheriff or whoever goes, "We are the ambulance."
Right.
It's like, okay, that's, you know, that's fair enough, I guess. And then the other line was when she said, "If I'd known you were coming, I would have put my face on." Like, okay, that's fine. I mean, yeah. That would pass muster in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, for example.
Sure.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is full of little glib asides like that, that are like, you know, it's not going to bust a gut laughing. This movie just shoots its shot. It's just got that one line, or, you know, those two lines, I guess. And that's all there is to it. So this is when the movie starts going to hell in a handbasket. I didn't know it was going to go to the ninth circle just yet, but this is when it starts to teeter, when it starts to lose its footing on the rickety footstool of normal bad and topple over. Leatherface gets into the back of the police van along with the ailing lady and, let's see,
the deputy. And the
sheriff's deputy. And then in the front, the sheriff's driving. Passenger seat is occupied by a blonde Zoomer gentrifier who is not long for this world. She's the first to go because when the old lady croaks, Leatherface awakens from his docile state and goes into a murder frenzy.
He breaks the deputy's arm and then stabs him with his own bones.
Yeah, he snaps his arm like it's a pretzel rod and then, yeah, drives the jagged bone shards into his throat. And then
it's the only vaguely interesting kill in the whole movie.
That's true. And then manipulates his gun hand in such a way that the gun goes off and shoots the driver through the neck or the head or something. And he crashes into I think just like a derelict piece of farming equipment.
Yeah.
So the blonde survives momentarily. First of all, and this is post-break business, there was no scene in the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and this is what makes it feel special when you go back and revisit it. It's so unlike any other slasher movie that came after it. There is, unless my memory is deceiving me, and I don't think it is, there is nary a scene in the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre where a character has to be quiet in order to evade a killer. Or in order to avoid detection. Mm-hmm. And this movie, at least the first half of this movie, is just rife with scenes like that. And it's really aggravating to me because the things that set the original TCM apart have not been replicated by really any of its follow-ups or even most any slasher movies trying to emulate it. You know, I feel like they're not. The things that I like most about the original movie have never been emulated because I feel like they haven't even been recognized by the overwhelming majority of filmmakers who have taken it upon themselves to try to carry this particular torch. So anyway, there's a long, tedious scene of her in the passenger seat trying to stay quiet and play possum while Leatherface is stomping around. He carves the face off the deputy and slaps it over his own mug.
No, he carves it off of his pseudo-mom.
Ah, yes, indeed, which might account for why it looks so droopy and bedraggled. He looks like such a dope. He's got this, once he puts the skin mask on, he's got this hangdog expression for the rest of the movie.
Well, and not to be a fucking pedant, but his name is not Skin Face.
Leatherface.
His name is Leatherface.
It needs to be tanned human skin. It needs to fit him like an old boot. If it's fresh skin, he just looks like he's some rando in a Rob Zombie movie. It sucks. Thank you. I'm glad that we both arrived at that conclusion. I'm sure at first glance. There's a laugh-out-loud funny shot of him standing up out of this field of dead sunflowers.
Incidentally, it is the, like, stock still.
Yes, so you
for the movie on Netflix. If you click on it, or even if you put your cursor over it, you're centered on Texas Chainsaw. So you got the blurb on the left, and this still on the right. And it took me the longest time. I didn't figure it out until after the movie. It reminded me of the cover for Everything is Illuminated, the movie. Elijah Wood standing in the field of sunflowers, just looking kind of sad and also bewildered. Literally, the only difference is that here the sunflowers are taller. They're still sunflower. Oh, and they're also
dead. Yeah.
But they're taller and they're dead. But otherwise, it's, again, somebody looking kind of bedraggled and bewildered and sad in the middle of a field of sunflowers. Mm-hmm. Why does Texas Chainsaw Massacre have anything in common with Everything is Illuminated? That is bonkers.
Now, of the two images, I find the one with Elijah Wood
less funny.
More eerie.
Yeah, right. Anyway, please continue.
So the blonde in the passenger seat gets got after laying low and trying to stay quiet and play possum and all of that bullshit. She gets gutted with either a knife or a lengthy shard of glass. I'm not sure which. And it's laborious. You know, you see her belly get zippered open. And, you know, there's needless to say, there's no kills like that in the original. But I don't even mind that, you know, new movies come along and they pour on the viscera in a way that the original didn't, because I don't expect bloodless slasher movies in 2022. However, the way it lingers on it, it again just feels antithetical to the spirit of the thing. This is just like, I don't know, the filmmakers just have completely different priorities than Toby Hooper and the gang. So she's dead. She, before the crash, you know, before Leatherface went berserk, she sent a text to her boyfriend, who again is the ringleader back in the ghost town. He's the one who was adamant about getting the Confederate flag taken down.
The old lady's dead, ... exclamation point.
Yes, ellipsis, exclamation point. Presumably she appended the exclamation point when the car crashed. So nothing much comes of that. I just thought it was amusing. My notes at this point are so dominated by, I'm not even talking about like the moment to moment filmmaking. It's just much more holistic grievances. Just a total, I'm going to have to really rein myself in lest I embark on
the post break, some kind of break.
4 hour long Jeremiah ad. There's some question of whether the old orphanage actually belongs to them rightfully, or whether the old lady who died in the back of the police van actually had a legitimate claim to it. And, you know, this is to make the Zoomer gentrifiers look all the more nefarious. And the two of them have a falling out. One of the girls goes inside, is rifling through an old desk, and finds a deed.
Title to the building.
Yeah, right.
It's like, so?
It could be obsolete. It looks old. I mean, it looks old as shit. It could have been, it could be totally outmoded at this point. It could have been replaced by a different piece of paper.
You know, this
in a different desk.
This isn't the Old West. You don't get, like, the deed to your land and then it's just permanently true.
You're right. This isn't like fucking Baron of Arizona, where Vincent Price can produce a deed that says he owns the state of Arizona and no one can contest it. You know, it's just, it's so...
Brain dead.
And it's brain dead because she has a really emotional reaction to it. Like, what have we done? We
cheated. She had the deed.
We murdered her. Which is also the open carry dude's reaction. The good
old boy. He seizes their car keys.
Yes.
And bus keys. The bus has arrived by this point.
Yeah, the party bus. Full of the obnoxious,
full of investors.
Obnoxious millennial Zoomer stereotypes, multicultural group of people whose cell phones are never out of their hands, you know, who talk in lingo. And it's just feels like this movie was made by like a 55-year-old, which I don't think is the case. But
no.
So there's just, I'll have a good deal more to say about that later. It's inescapable. So, speaking of the open carry dickhead, he's slightly chummier with one member of the crew, who is the sibling, the sister of the girl who is having an emotional breakdown.
A deed-related breakdown.
Yeah, over dirty deeds done dirt cheap.
Yeah, so Elsie Fisher, eighth grade,
yes,
is the sister, and she's the one who's...
reaching across the aisle.
Right. She, incidentally,
oh, yes.
I don't know how we elided this.
I was just getting to it.
Okay. So she is the survivor of a school shooting.
Yes, and this is shown to us via flashback in no uncertain terms, her on the ground, awash in blood.
Surrounded by, you know, student corpses.
Yes, slain peers of hers.
And she's in his garage or whatever, and she sees his fucking, you know, AR-15 just sitting out.
Yeah, and she's I think I don't have a good eye for fucking firearms because I'm a cuck, but I think that's what it was, you know.
Yeah, and she's like kind of looking at it, and he's like, "Oh, you ever fired one?" And he takes the magazine out and makes sure it's not loaded, nothing in the chamber and so forth, and she's holding it, and lo and behold, she fucking wigs out because she's got PTSD, no yeah. fucking duh. And yet she continues hanging out with him for a few more minutes to the point where her sister shows up later and freaks out because she comes out of the bathroom smoking a cigarette while this guy's like sitting on his bed. She thinks they fucked or something.
Uh-huh. So the one thing more, this is more consequential than the text with the strange punctuation, before she dies during the period, the interminable period where she's just trying not to make a peep, the blonde in the passenger seat of the police van radios for help, you know, whispering, "He's got a human skin mask." She says something. And I guess the fucking,
gas station guy's got like a police scanner.
He's got and so he proceeds to contact Sally Hardesty, who in Jamie Lee Curtis Halloween requel trilogy mode,
Evil Dies Tonight
is this tough as nails, hard ass survivalist kind of doomsday prepper old lady who answers her phone. You know, she's like gutting a cow in a shed, gets a call, picks it up with a bloody hand. "This is Hardesty."
The actress has kind of a weathered face and yes. looks more than a little bit like Dennis Hopper, which is funny because he plays Lefty in Texas Chainsaw 2.
Yeah, I want, obviously Dennis Hopper's dead. So incidentally is the actress who originally played Sally Hardesty. So they're trying to do the legacy character thing, and it's totally fucking botched as far as I'm concerned. If it's not actually, you know, Jamie Lee up there, or whoever the case may be, you know, if it's not actually fucking Courtney Cox,
then you can't do it.
Yeah, or it just won't have the same weight. You could maybe get away with it, but then they fucking butcher that character in innumerable ways, literally as well as figuratively. Later on, during the part of this movie that made me molecularly distinct from the Matt Gerandasey that I was 74 minutes before we hit play. So she suits up and gets ready for battle, and I'm going to have more to say about the characterization of her and how lazy it is after the break. I mean, you said that she looks kind of weathered. She does look like she's been hanging out in the baking Texas sun since...
For 48 years.
Since she survived the massacre. When, in the original film, I don't think that she's a Texas native.
No.
Or if she is, she's not from that part of Texas. They're venturing off the map in that movie, which is an old horror chestnut that I love. Whether it's fucking Marion Crane driving deep into Arizona to make it to the Bates Motel or whatever the hell. You're going... She being Sally, elects to live in the nightmare place, you know, into her dotage. Just to hunt this guy down. Whereas, you know, last time we saw her, she was in the back of this pickup truck cackling with glee because she was finally putting this shithole in her rearview mirror. It's like, it's totally fucking incongruous. I just don't buy it. It's not just that it's a new actress. It just is not the same person.
No.
Oh, when she's suiting up and getting ready to go, she looks at a Polaroid of herself and all of her mates. From
including that, invalid brother Franklin.
Yeah, that ill-fated voyage into bumfuck nowhere back in 73. And she hears like echoey ghost laughter as she looks at the Polaroid.
That's right.
Whew. That might be the point where the possum died. Where the light went out of its eyes, but the horror show was far from over. So let's see. Leatherface starts offing people. I think that he starts with the dude who was more belligerent about getting the lady thrown out of what I guess is actually legally her house. Maybe, who knows? There's a really limp dick homage to the original movie where he's, you know, walking through, I think, the orphanage, and there's some like pots and pans hanging that are kind of clinking together in a way that's meant to like sonically recall all of the fucking stringed cans and the weird bone totems and shit that were around the Leatherface house in the original movie. And then he gets dropped by Leatherface, or Fresh Skin Face as the case may be, takes a chainsaw through the mouth, almost like a Joker smile that goes like all the way to his ear. And he looks to be dead, but isn't, gets up, staggers out of the building. Now the girl, the older sister, is also being hunted by Leatherface, and now she's doing the gotta be quiet.
Hide in the closet, hide under the bed.
Yeah, that blah, whole blah, routine. Blah. While she's doing that, Leatherface is getting dolled up. And this was a subtle feature of the original film. I think during the dinner scene, he's got like a little rouge on the cheeks, maybe a little lipstick, because he's like playing homemaker in that scene. You know, it creates that nightmare nuclear family dynamic where you've got the patriarch and the, I guess, matriarch and the son in the form of the hitchhiker, who's a little more of the kind of standoffish archetypal teenager. But this is something that got ramped up in later installments. Next Generation lays it on especially thick. He's basically like, it's like a drag queen Leatherface in that movie. And it's not something I've ever cared for. I mean, I want it to be applied with some delicacy, because you risk hijacking the character and just turning it into this, like, you know, like gay panic thing,
right?
If you stress it too much, which this movie doesn't for the most part, but this scene devotes a lot of attention to it. Again, while the lady is hiding in the closet, meanwhile, the guy who survived his encounter with Leatherface, despite having his jaw,
flappy jaw,
yeah, flapping in the breeze, he staggers into the street. Open carry Numbnuts comes after him, you know, where are you going, city boy, that kind of thing. Doesn't see that he's covered in blood until he gets right up close to him, and they're met, the two of them, by the woman from the bank,
the realtor, basically,
yeah, right, who organized the whole tour bus excursion. And I thought for sure that this was going to be another Halloween Kills thing where the open carry dude was going to be blamed. Like, they were going to think it was a hate crime because he's like cradling the dude when she, and the lady from the bank is also black. So I thought she was going to see this and misconstrue it. And this movie was going to go even further into the fucking pea-brained, like, racial tension stuff that it established in the first half.
Yeah.
It didn't, mercifully, I guess, but that's a small consolation, I guess. Everyone boards the party bus, except the open carry guy, who goes for his guns. I think this is where he meets his end. He and Leatherface duke it out, and Leatherface wins, despite being, you know, a septuagenarian. Yeah. I mean, he's not really, he doesn't look that old. I don't know. He ages, he's got a different metabolism than the rest of us. I mean, we see a good deal of him without his mask on before he flips shit in the back of the police van.
Which is also a fucking mistake.
Yes. Well, yeah, big time.
But he, open carry, manages to give his, which is to say their, keys back to the older sister who's hiding under the bed at this time.
Uh-huh.
He's extending his hand slowly out just as Leatherface brings a sledgehammer down on his skull for the first of about 10 times.
Yes.
So there's, again, more tiptoe bullshit. She eventually gets to the stairs, but then Leatherface sees her and like throws the hammer at her and knocks her down to the floor below and then through the floorboards. She's trying to crawl through the crawl space under there. He's chasing her with the blade of the chainsaw through the floor.
He winds up sawing through a septic pipe, I think is what it is.
Yeah, I think so.
Some like septic sludge spills out onto her head, which is, you know, an apt visualization of my internal emotional state the entire time I was watching this. I felt like fucking Andy Dufresne if there was no cleansing baptismal rain waiting for me when I got out of the pipe. And
Andy Dufresne, the man who crawled through a river of shit and stayed there.
It's this movie all over. And it really reaches its apotheosis right here. So Bank Lady knows what's up. The two sisters know what's up. They all make it onto the party bus. The rest of the caricatures, cell phones in hand, are just totally clueless. Seagull people, just total bird brains. they're not real. They're totally fucking facile. So Leatherface gets onto the bus, and they all think it's like...
Well, they get the bus moving. Uh-huh. They give the keys to the bus driver. They get him moving. And this is just, like, shot and cut together incredibly incompetently. Because what it looks like is that the bus is rolling down the street. Leatherface has gotten out of the building, and he's in an alleyway. But he looks like he's about 10 to 15 feet away from the bus. And, like, the bus is easily going to get away from him.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden, it cuts back to the interior of the bus, and we're like, like, he's cutting into one of the tires or something. And sure enough, they have to, like, come to a stop. And bus driver gets out, and we don't see what happens. And then all of a sudden, his head's thrown into the bus.
It, like, lands on the stairs, on the steps. It was a noiseless decapitation. We hear no revving of chainsaw, no vrum, 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 nothing. His head just lands at their feet. And I thought this whole time that everyone was fucking on the same wavelength now. I thought everyone on the bus was privy to what they were up against. And this has not been established by the framing, by the editing, nothing. It came as a total fucking shock to me to learn that all of the partiers were just still partying. And that didn't even feel like a joke being deployed. That's like, oh, isn't it funny how clueless they are? I mean, they are clueless, and that is the joke. But the reveal that they're totally out to sea doesn't land like a reveal. It's like the filmmakers don't think it's strange that the head didn't get their attention and the starting and stopping didn't.
Not to give this movie any kind of credit at all, this thing, unlike with you, it was not a speed bump for me.
Uh-huh.
Because your point about the bus starting and stopping is well taken, I guess.
But I was penning a letterboxed screed for much of this movie. It began in earnest right about now, so it's possible I missed something.
So
more than possible.
They're back in the back of the party bus drinking in, you know, the neon room.
Ah.
And I'm pretty sure there's also like a divider. So the back of the bus is closed off. So basically they wouldn't have seen the head. They wouldn't have seen the people up front like go, go, go. They would have just, that's weird. The bus started and then stopped. Let's keep drinking.
Given that fresh skin face hit the switch on his chainsaw that put it in stealth mode, I guess there would have been nothing to alert them to the fact that their lives
were
in danger.
They're bumping EDM back there or whatever, uh-huh. So they might have not have even heard it. So,
well,
again,
we didn't hear it, more to the point.
Sure. So, again, there's 1,000 things wrong with this movie. That did not bother me in the way it bothered you.
Well, let's dispense with that speed bump, because what's about to happen, I'm sure, infuriated you just as much as it did me. Leatherface makes it onto the party bus, and all of the partiers, all of the gentrifiers, hold up their cell phones and start Snapchatting him or Instagramming him or fucking TikToking him.
We
see a bunch of cell phone interfaces. It looks more like TikTok. And we see, you know, like a string of comments.
One of which is from the director, David Blue Garcia.
Yes, all three of his names. That will live in infamy.
Saying, who hired this clown?
You did.
Fucker, you did.
And that's the joke.
Right.
The reason that we both saw his name, because it is a blink and you miss it gag on one of the many phones being held aloft, the reason that we caught it on the second pass, the reason that there even was a second pass, is because we had to rewind, because there was a line that was so apocalyptically awful that we wanted to make sure we were hearing it right. And the line is this. There's an Asian dude. Of course, it's a multicultural party bus of an invasive species. A polyglot abyss on wheels. This fucking guy is holding up his cell phone just like they all are. Zoomer sheeple that they are. Millennials, whatever the fuck they are these days. He's holding up his phone, staring down Leatherface. And he says, if you try anything, you're canceled, bro. I don't know if he said bro.
He said bro. Yeah.
You heard it here, folks.
Try anything and you're canceled, bro.
Ellipsis! !! And then Leatherface just turns it into an abattoir. He just absolutely wipes the floor with all of them. Eighth grade has a PTSD flashback to her high school, which makes an obnoxious is letting it off too easy, makes an indescribably annoying scene even more odious. The fucking bank lady looks like she's getting away, and then she gets sawed in half. Again, we linger on it. It's just a slaughterhouse, and it's not the carnage that made me feel this way, but what I felt during this scene, honest to God, this is, I think, I went into something of a fugue earlier when I was laying into this movie before we got into the plot rundown, but I think that I mentioned having like a physiological reaction to it, actual physical aversion.
You did.
This is the moment when my skin got cold and I felt like I was in a sinking submarine. I was trapped on this party bus, so it is physically confining. You got the oppressive blue light, you know, the neon, whatever. But it's more than that. It wasn't just like the fucking mise-en-scene, and it wasn't just the fact that the screen was awash in gore. It was something fundamental that I was witnessing that just made me feel like I was sinking like a stone to the bottom of some ocean trench, and like the light was dwindling into nothing, and my oxygen was running out, and I was done for. I'm at pains to even convey how upset I was during. And I never recovered from it, because the rest of the movie is operating at this level. It's beyond hopeless.
Yeah, I think it might have clicked for me at the, like, fourth second of watching the realtor woman's intestine slither over the windowsill.
Yes.
To finish that shot.
Mm-hmm. Uncoiling itself over the side of the bus.
While Leatherface is standing there looking out the window for why? There are more people to kill. He's not taking a break to look out the window.
Yeah, but there's
this woman's dead. He knows that. He's got more people to kill.
And there's one person in particular that he, for some reason, has no interest in killing. And that's Sally Hardesty, the one that got away. She arrives on the scene, tough as nails, hard ass. And she, just like fucking Halloween Kills, thinks that she has this mythic, fated rendezvous with Leatherface.
So, real quick, Elsie Fisher and her sister, they have retreated into the bathroom, the bus bathroom, and have escaped out of a roof hatch, like emergency exit out of the bathroom ceiling. And they're running down the street, and then, Sally pulls up in her SUV and tells them to hop in the back. And then, she's like... It's so fucking baffling, because in addition to, being convinced that this pre-verbal, like, not human in a mental sense,
avatar
creature in a human suit.
Yes. Because she starts...
Has a personal vendetta against her.
Yeah, that he could be anyone's Moriarty is nonsense. I mean, even Michael Myers, who's a rabid dog, is more calculating than Leatherface. Leatherface was only ever one facet of a family of cannibal killers. That's the only milieu where he makes sense. He needs his people. He needs his clan. And he's the muscle, but he's just one head on the Hydra. To treat him like he's Moriarty is absolutely sanity shredding. So she's got him at gunpoint. She got this double-barreled shotgun.
Oh, also, the other completely fucking idiotic thing that Sally apparently believes, she says to the two sisters, like, you're the ones he wants. Guess you're gonna have to stay here. So she leaves them locked in the back of her Texas Ranger SUV with, like, the grate between the two rows of seats.
And it doesn't make a lick of goddamn sense, because you hear that and you think, okay, that's the inverse of the kind of stuff that Laurie Strode would be ranting and raving about in one of the latter-day Halloween movies. I'm the one he wants is what a character like this is supposed to believe. But she seems to think that he'll spare her for some reason, and indeed he does. She comes upon him. He's hunkered down on the edge of a bed in, I think, the orphanage It must be. They just go in and out of that same building this whole goddamn movie. You keep thinking they're going to get away from it, and somehow they never do. He's just sitting there almost sullenly, like his Xbox got confiscated by his parents. And she is monologuing at him, saying, like, say you remember me.
Say my name.
Say my friend's names. What? My invalid brother, Franklin. As you said, he's pre-fucking verbal. And so he just gets up and walks out, and she's shattered. She's like, you don't remember me.
No shit!
It just makes her look like such a goddamn doofus. I mean, Halloween Kills makes a joke of Laurie, but that is Sherlock Moriarty compared to this. That's Batman Joker. That's like, in those movies...
This is Sherlock Holmes and the Hound of the Baskervilles.
My greatest foe.
This giant dog.
Our little chess game continues, my quadrupedal friend. At least, you know, as fucking dumbfucked as Halloween Kills was, at least in that franchise, you've got all the sequel baggage to indicate to fans of the series that maybe Laurie and Michael do have this kind of mythic bond, because multiple sequels have tried to impress that upon you. And so I can understand.
Even as Halloween Kills is trying to scrub those.
Yes, and you're right, exactly. So Halloween Kills,
still in the air.
Halloween Kills retcons those movies. So it shouldn't even have to address that idea, but it still feels the need to. And it's idiotic in execution, if not in principle, but at least you can understand where the idea is coming from. Here, I'm just at a complete loss. So she gets back on that horse, Sally, and comes out guns blazing into the street, and Leatherface wheels on her and, you know, gets stabbed in the belly by this runty little knife that she's got. I don't remember if she shoots him. It wouldn't matter. These guys are always indestructible, whether there's an in-universe rationale for that or not, or whether they're supposed to be in their mid-70s. He rams a chainsaw through her spine, through her stomach and her spine, lifts her into the air, and
jiggles her around a little bit, and then hurls her body onto a pile of garbage.
Yeah, he does everything short of, like, twirling her body around like she's mounted on a big drill or something. I mean, she's just ragdolling. Her blood is falling on the camera lens. It's you couldn't make mincemeat of her in a more humiliating fashion if you tried. And I'm sure that was their aim, to butcher a sacred cow, because they're edgelords. And as stupid as that is, it's about to get even stupider, because she survives this somehow.
You have to kill off one of the legacy characters so we know it's serious.
God. So she lands on the trash pile, and she's not quite down for the count. She gives a pep talk to one of the girls, the eighth grade, I'm sure, right?
Yeah.
Has to be. And gives her shotgun. You rightly predicted that eighth grade was going to overcome her PTSD in truly back-asswards fashion by picking up the AR-15. And just ripping Leatherface a new one with it. And that kind of happens and kind of doesn't. What happens in this, to call it muddled would be wildly charitable, this insane climax, it's so bizarre, because you've got Sally's shotgun, which has this kind of totemic torch-passing significance. You've got the AR-15, which is invested with a degree of significance because of eighth grade's background and her trauma to do with the school shooting. And then you've got Leatherface's own chainsaw, which is the classic, like, stake to the vampire's heart. Like, surely that's the only thing that'll kill him. And all three of these weapons get trotted out in the most haphazard way imaginable. I was typing furiously at this point, which surely accounts for some of my confusion. But the whole scene, as I'm sure you'll attest, is just meaningless.
I will attempt to recap. So first, Elsie Fisher goes and gets the AR-15 and tries shooting Leatherface, and it doesn't work because she didn't put the mag back in, so it has no bullets. Leatherface...
Which is fucking taken wholesale from the original Scream, right? Courtney Cox. I didn't forget the safety that time, you bastard, or whatever she says.
Right.
You know, it's like we're dusting off that gag from 30 fucking years ago.
Leatherface, like, knocks the gun out of her hand, but then I don't know.
And it somehow bothers me too, because it's like still, she's like still a lib at the end of the day. So she, you know, she doesn't really know how to use it. If she did,
she would know it needs bullets.
Yeah, she would know how to stand her ground and defend herself. And so the movie is just, you know, Christ.
So somehow Leatherface like knocks it out of her hand, but then decides not to kill her, or I don't know. Maybe this actually happened before Sally initially gets fucking gutted. But anyway,
I don't see how. Maybe
whatever. Then she and the girl have a no. I know what it is. The sister, I think, distracts him somehow. Anyway,
yeah, she enters the fray. I remember that. There's a bunch of weird, sort of jittery slow-mo, and at one point Leatherface brays like an elephant.
So,
well, she's like clinging to his back, the older sister is.
No, that's after they go inside.
I thought we were already inside. Okay.
We're not inside, because she still hasn't talked to Sally yet. Sally, fucking duh, this is what happens. Sally, I'm getting there. Sally, who is, as we said, not yet dead. She is not yet dead. shoots him with her shotgun a couple of times.
She pegs him from
and then
the
he like, and, you know, flees into like a derelict movie theater. And then Elsie Fisher goes over and it's like, hey, thanks or whatever. And Sally says, don't leave. You got to kill him or you'll be. She either says haunted or hunted by him forever. Right. And if it's haunted, it's just like a shitty throwaway line. If it's hunted, that's some Halloween Kills level complete fucking gibberish. Like, Michael Myers has haunted this town for 40... No, he hasn't! He killed some people 40 years ago and has never been back in this continuity.
Well, she says at one point, you know, I've been looking for him for 50 years, and I heard the ghost of Matt Gerandese, a dead man, who is not speaking right now. He died. He's 6 feet deep. I heard my own fucking ghost going 50 years from back when we ripped into Halloween Kills. I never imagined that we would get, I can't believe this is just part of my vocabulary now. I can't believe we got a requel that makes Halloween Kills look like it knows anything about anything by comparison. I mean, I hated that movie, and it's, I don't know what to tell you.
So, Elsie Fisher gets the shotgun, and Sally is actually dead now, I guess. Goes in there. I don't know where her sister got off to at this point for the time being, but she goes in and goes after Leatherface. There's some, like, this chainsaw is sitting on the ground for some reason. She gets knocked to the ground. Leatherface throws the chainsaw to knock her down when she gets back up. He kicks the shotgun away. He's about to kill her. And this is when her sister has leapt on Leatherface's back and is trying to distract him or beat on his face or whatever. And then Elsie Fisher gets the shotgun. Leatherface has thrown her sister off and is standing a few feet in front of this bottomless pit of water that's just hanging out in the middle of this building for some reason in the sweltering Texas heat. This fucking water
ghost town, yeah,
has not evaporated. Elsie Fisher shoots him twice, thus emptying the rest of the shotgun, and this does not quite kill him and also does not knock him quite far back enough to fall into the puddle.
And once again, she's confused as to why her gun stopped working.
Whoop, no bullets. What do you think, I'm fucking stupid, Hans? You know, like, and then her sister has gotten hold of the shotgun, which has taken which has taken a shotgun blast to, like, the motor end, and somehow still works. And she just gives him a quick, like, slash under the chin.
You called it a love tap, and that...
Yeah, that's exactly what it fucking is.
That makes it sound like a more violent collision than what it actually is. You know, it's
just a nudge into the water.
Yeah, it's like, it's a fender bender. It's like he just... There's no even cosmetic damage. She doesn't slice his leather face, much less his actual face under that. There's no nothing. And then he collapses into the water and sinks and dies. And if you believe that, I got.
I've got a bridge to nowhere to sell you, yes. You know, or whatever. So they go outside, and I guess dawn has broken by this point, and
as have I.
And they get into their Tesla. Oh, by the way, they were driving a Tesla this whole time.
And this only comes into play now. There's no gags to do with, like, driving assistance in the first act that would have set up this ending. It's apparent that they're driving a Tesla, but that just makes them seem like fishes out of water more so than they otherwise would have. It just felt like another signifier to the effect of, like, look at these city slickers. But now, all of a sudden, the fact that it's a Tesla becomes totally instrumental.
So Elsie's sister is like, oh, well, you know, let's go home, and punches into the GPS like, autopilot, go home. And it's like, Tesla does not have accurate fucking GPS maps for this ghost town.
Elon Musk is going to put you inside that mystery pond inside of the building, inside of the old movie theater. I think it was supposed to be that Tesla's going to go right off a fucking cliff.
So the Tesla starts rolling down the street, and then Leatherface, of course, fucking shows up and drags the sister out of the car, and then we get the reenactment of the end of the original film. So Elsie Fisher stands up through the sunroof, the open sunroof of the Tesla, looking back while it's autopiloting away, sees her sister on her knees with Leatherface holding her by the hair, and just chops off her head. And all Elsie Fisher could do is yell from the center, no,
yeah,
no. And then Leatherface, of course, does the chainsaw ballet thing, but way dumber.
It's indescribable. It's so ugly and mean. And I don't mean just like in the sense that it hurt my feelings. I mean, like, in the old timey sense, like mean as in small and insubstantial and insignificant. I mean, it's like the ending of that original movie, it's such a powerful catharsis. It's a light at the end of the tunnel for Sally, who of course will never be the same. She might spend the rest of her life cackling like that, for all we know. But she's alive, inconceivably. She's escaped from the jaws of the devil. And Leatherface is flailing about impotently because the bird flew the coop, you know, and he has no way of consoling himself other than slashing the empty air because he wants to kill something and there's nothing there for him to kill.
But here he's doing a fucking victory dance.
Yes! He if he'd started dabbing, it couldn't have been more hateful.
And then we get like a fucking dubstep EDM drop of an end credits
that samples the immortal noise from the opening of the original movie where they're exhuming the corpses, the disinterred corpses in the graveyard that have been fashioned into those ghoulish, like, human totem poles. It's the camera, it's the flash that, like, that just sounds kind of like a factory in hell, you know?
Right.
It's a great bit of sound design. And here, yeah, it's just some Skrillex nonsense. And then, you know, credits roll for 8-9 minutes to get this movie past the 80-minute mark.
Yeah, we skipped over those, needless to say. And we get a pointless, utterly, utterly pointless post-credits scene of Leatherface stumbling down the road back to the old farmhouse.
Yeah, that's
It's like,
doesn't even get his foot in the door.
No, you don't. The only reason you would need that scene is if you didn't have him kill the sister. If we're still meant to believe going into the post-credits scene that Leatherface was dead. This is the post-credits scene that is supposed to establish he's alive, except we already fucking knew that. This is just useless. Oh, he went home. Whoop-de-fucking-do.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hillbilly smoking a cigarette, turning to the dead possum and saying, was it good for you? It's just like, it's like just the final indignity.
Yeah, and then looks out at us, what about you? You know, like, fuck. More after the break.
This is Hardesty.
Sally, I'm afraid your old friend's back.
50 years I've been waiting for this night. Just to see him again.
Who?
Leatherface.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Looks like it's you that he wants.
I'm not gonna let him kill you. Fear no evil. Fear no evil.
Try anything and you're canceled, bro.
Oh, fuck.
And we're back, for better or worse. Matt, I know you're raring to go, so take it away.
Well, it just pains me because I know that there's stuff that I'm going to not get around to, stuff that's going to slip my mind. I'm going to wake up in a cold sweat, you know, I'll have nightmares about this movie and wake up like, huh, and just grab, you know, my partner, shake them awake. I have so much bile to excrete. I'm like cold and sweaty now. It's like this movie gave me food poisoning. I feel unwell. I'm really in a bad way. I knew that there was, or I suspected, I predicted, I had a hunch that this movie was going to commit some blunders that are common to Texas Chainsaw Massacre sequels, and I was not wrong about most of those predictions. I had a feeling going in. The last movie, the last Chainsaw movie that I had yet to catch up with, I caught up with just a few weeks ago. It was not in anticipation of watching this. It was just coincidentally. I think that a bunch of them just got added to Netflix in the run-up to this turd getting fucking shat out into my screaming mouth. And then the only one I hadn't seen was The Beginning, which I watched, which is nothing special, but which compared to this is Bridge on the River Kwai. You know,
it's Kubrick.
It's one of the ones with Arlie Ermey in it. So if nothing else, you know,
there's that.
He classes it up as best he can. And the thing that I disliked most about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning, is how much of it is spent with close-up shots where you, A, see way too much of Leatherface's face, which is bad, just on the face of it. And secondarily, or actually more importantly, what irked me even more was that not just that you see his face, but what his face is doing. Because what his face does for most of that movie is glare at people. He's angry. He's got a score to settle. And that is not
what Leatherface is.
It's not part of the spectrum of emotion that he can access. In the original movie, his eyes, he's got like the eyes of a fretful dog in the original movie. They're just glassy and empty when he's killing people. And when his quarry is getting away from him, he looks like he's going to be in trouble. He looks a little bit mournful, a little bit anxious, but never angry. It's just not something that he ever taps into that we can see. Maybe there's something behind the mask that we're not privy to, but I just don't see it in him. And in all the fucking sequels, except for the one that Tobe Hooper himself did, not coincidentally. Well, actually, I feel like 3 and 4 might be a little bit better about this, but certainly all of the ones made from like the turn of the millennium onward, he's just pissed off chronically, and this movie is no exception. And that's not my Leatherface. It just makes him. It's just Rob Zombie shit at that point. You know, I don't care about the chip on his shoulder. He's just some jackass at that point. He's just some aggrieved brute, just this hulking, roid ragey monster man. And I couldn't care less. You know, when he's glaring through his greasy locks at the policeman right up until he starts wearing his de facto mother's face. And it's not his MO. You know, I mean, there's a sense in which just conceptually, fundamentally, spiritually, no one who has tried to take the reins of this series actually gives a good goddamn or just understands. Just there's no comprende. There's just no comprehension of what actually makes Leatherface tick, or what made the original movie a horse of a different color. You know, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre is so odd. It's gotten more in common with like folk horror kind of stuff. It's a slasher movie in that it's got a slasher narrative spine. It's really more of a proto slasher movie because it's pre-Halloween, same year as Black Christmas, which can also stake a claim to being a progenitor of the genre, subgenre, whatever you want to call it. But really, like, tonally, it's got this paranoid Watergate-y kind of atmosphere where everyone is in on it. Every yokel that they bump into on this vacation is connected to this cannibal clan. The guy who runs the gas station and the hitchhiker that they happen to pick up. And then, you know, they meet Leatherface, and self-evidently Leatherface is a maniac. But the people that they encounter who seem like they have their heads screwed on a little tighter are also just as deranged. And that's what really elevates the original movie for me, that feeling of the ground giving way beneath your feet. That like, oh no, that nightmare logic where there's just a nexus of insanity in the asshole of the world in Texas that's drawing you deeper into something that feels genuinely profound, like an actual, I mean, I keep using the word abyss or abyssal this episode just to try to get a handle on what I'm feeling. But there's a gulf in that movie, that first movie, that I find really compelling. I mean, the opening credits, after the bodies are exhumed in the graveyard, and you hear the newscaster talking about, you know, a grisly discovery in such county. And then he transitions to talking about global news, and you can barely hear it. It plays out under the opening credits, which are just this infernal kind of red. The font was all fucked up in this movie, too. You mentioned this before I did. It's like this deep blue, this like Michael Mann or old school Catherine Bigelow kind of cool blue.
Yeah.
Big blocky letters. It's totally fucked up.
Yeah, it looks like shit. Well, I pointed it out to Matt because that is a bit of a Matt on this podcast trope. He likes to single out opening credit font.
My favorite part of The Conjuring.
Right.
As I never hesitate. Likes. I never hesitate to point out, my favorite part of any Conjuring movie is the opening seconds of the first one, because it's aping Texas Chainsaw Massacre with the yellow letters scrolling up the black screen.
And I remember, I think the only thing you liked about The Prodigy was the spooky red font.
Yeah, the title looks like it should be on a vintage horror paperback. From like a Rosemary's Baby, like an Ira Levin kind of paperback,
right,
from the 60s or 70s.
So anyway, yes, that's why I pointed it out, and we both immediately agreed, yeah, no, it looks like shit. What the hell is this?
So when the newscaster in that original movie, he transitions away from talking about this weird local crime bulletin to talking about oil fires raging out of control, and, you know, such and it just feels like a world spinning off kilter. It's just there's something shambolic about the philosophy of that first movie that has a little bit of profundity to it. And, you know, you might watch it and not feel like it actually speaks to anything meaningful. And you might not even be wrong. It's just, it strikes a chord with me. I'm not saying it's, you know, fucking Immanuel Kant, but it's not nothing. There's something there. And it's, for me, there's artistic merit to spare in that original movie. And there is next to no artistic merit in a lot of the TCM movies that have come along since. And there is absolutely nothing good about Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2022, other than the like 1.5 lines that I already talked about as being a little bit clever, but clever on the order of Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2, which is a deliberately stupid,
right,
willfully disappointing spoof of the original.
Yes. I ejected, I think, most of my bile about this film over the course of the synopsis. I mean, I don't feel the hatred any less, but I don't know how much more I have to say about it.
No, I don't feel it any less. I need to call up my loved ones and tell them to prepare to be loved a little less by me, because I had to jettison some of it
to make room. I have less capacity for love now.
Yeah.
It's just wholly misbegotten top to bottom. And the original draft of the screenplay was apparently written by Fede Alvarez and his buddy, who he let direct Don't Breathe 2. And I just want to shake them both by the collar and say, what the fuck did you do? No, really, what the fuck did you do? And it also makes me wonder, okay, yeah, they get the story credit. How much did whatever fucking hack screenwriter who wrote the shooting draft, how much did they retain and how much was different? And therefore, how much blame can I really lay on Fede Alvarez and his buddy?
Well, and it's produced by Kim Henkel, too, who wrote or co-wrote the original. And Next Generation, the fourth one, is basically his baby. And that one's bug-fuck-insane, you know? So it's possible that he had a hand in this, too, this bedlam.
Although that could just as easily be we're going to pay him to attach his name to this
yes
product and make it look more legit.
When his name came up, I almost yelled, like, get Kim Henkel's fucking name out of your dirty mouth. That it's appalling. And the real benchmark for this movie doesn't even appear to be Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1974, because to the extent that it cares about that movie's legacy at all, the new movie only cares about toppling it over and making it sit on whoopee cushions and just debasing it the way it does with Sally Hardesty. It builds her up to be this kind of action hero, which is what requels do now. I found it uninspired when Scream did it. I remember complaining about how both of those returning legacy characters, the two women, are just kind of carbon copies, just like kind of
they're samey. Yeah.
Samey, yeah. They have like a hive mind where they're just both kind of tough as nails and badass and hard ass and kind of exactly the same way, because we're all following the Jamie Lee Curtis example now, I guess. And I just can't believe that the Halloween reboot requel, soft fucking whatever, is what we're all aspiring to now. I think this trend, if it doesn't die a natural death, then it needs to be put down, because it's really yielding some of the worst movies I've seen in a good long while. I mean, of the three that I just rattled off, the new Scream is definitely the best. Well, okay, no, so it's Halloween 2018, what?
Yes.
Right? I liked that a little more than Scream. Liked Scream a good deal more than Halloween Kills. And Halloween Kills was inconceivably better than this.
Somehow.
We did it, folks. And I just don't...
We found bottom.
So they... Yeah, don't tempt fate.
Okay, we're safe.
That was the feds about to break down the door because I threatened to break some guy's thumbs like 4 hours ago. I must have cooled off a little bit, because when you brought up Fede Alvarez and his writing partner, I did not feel like dispatching hitmen to make an example of them. I might just be too exhausted to have any such grandiose plans at this point. God, my fucking face hurts. Like my skeleton is trying to break out of my body. So, right. So has Sally Hardesty set up to be this hardcore action chick, which would bother me just because it's played out. So I didn't like that to begin with. And then they try to subvert it by turning her into Leatherface's plaything, basically. He breaks her first psychologically and then physically, and she's useless.
Or your body. Mrs. Hardesty.
If you'd started monologuing like that, like fucking, it was Tom Hardy behind the flesh mask that whole time, it wouldn't have felt less like Leatherface
right
than it already did. One spiteful glare is all it takes for me to just go, nah, that ain't him. That's not my guy. You know, it's just, it's not the, you know, the big anxious bloodhound that I remember from the Tobe Hooper original. So both directions they take Sally in this movie are equally worthless. The wannabe doomsday prepper Laurie Strode angle, which is without merit and totally unjustified because it's a new actress and it doesn't make any sense for Sally to wind up in that place psychologically or geographically. And then when they try to subvert it and flip it on its head and turn her into ground pork, it's even more worthless. It just plumbs new depths continuously for its last 35-40 minutes, however long, and it takes you down with it. I'm still, I'm in the dock! I would take a flamethrower to this movie.
If it wasn't in the cloud.
Yeah, if I was still me. If I was still Matt Gerandasi.
If you were the Matt Gerandasi you were 2 hours ago.
Yeah,
3 hours ago.
Four, however long. Here's an indication of the shititude that we're dealing with here. The absolute suck shititude of this movie. The new face is a train wreck. And I can't even bring myself to care. Like, it that would be the biggest flaw in a competent, or even, you know, subcompetent Texas Chainsaw movie. If that face had been in the Alexandra Daddario one, it would be a laughingstock. It would be the worst thing about that movie. In this movie, it doesn't even stand out from the rest of the abattoir mess. It's just part and parcel of how ill-conceived the whole thing is. It's saggy. It looks like Droopy's voice rather than Bane's should come out of it if he were to talk. He's got these like jowls. He just looks kind of glum. He looks...
Oh, gee.
I didn't know you had that one in your back pocket.
I thought about it for a second, and I had to summon it up. Going down, sure.
I always just go to Roger Rabbit first, where he's the elevator attendant.
Right.
There are some shots where he looks like Dan Aykroyd in Nothing But Trouble. And, like, how is that not the worst thing in the picture? It doesn't even register as a problem, because there's nothing but trouble. There's nothing but problems as far as the eye can see. It's cohesively shitty.
Yeah. Like I said, misbegotten from the ground up to the core.
And this unbelievably cynical stuff with the school shooting trauma, you know, just checking a box off the zeitgeist to-do list. It's like, okay, so like halfway through this movie, I thought that I had my biggest burn on lock. It made it into my Letterboxd screed. this is more a reaction to the first half of the movie with its completely dead on arrival, like social satire with the gentrification stuff and the racial tension and the don't mess with Texas crap. I thought like Gabriel in Malignant, the like sadistic, freakish conjoined twin.
Yeah.
If
sentient teratoma.
If Jordan Peele had a Gabriel, that creature could make a movie like this, or would write and direct a movie like this. That's what I kept thinking. If Jordan Peele's teratoma came to life,
it would be named David Blue Garcia.
On the basis of this movie, yes. And particularly the first half of this movie. Everything up through the party bus massacre. One wrong move and I'll cancel you, bro. Or try anything and I'll cancel you, bro, is actually what he said. I should know. We rewound so I could hear it a second time. It's like, what if Jordan Peele was evil, talentless, and stupid? Now we have our answer. It beggars belief. Fucking the Halloween requels really do feel like the benchmark for me. I said as much earlier. I want to try to explain what I mean by that without getting back onto the Sally Hardesty hate train, or this new fucking imposter, this tulpa that they're calling Sally Hardesty. So they're pulling into the town, which I guess is the town from the original movie where they were vacationing. They keep calling it Harlow. This name comes up several times. They get pulled over at one point by the sheriff and his deputy. We didn't even talk about this scene because there's no point. The sheriff is like, "Welcome to Harlow," swats the hood, and off they go. And then they're driving off. There's a sign that says "Welcome to Harlow, population 1,000 something and dropping all the time due to chainsaw related incidents." And again, "Welcome to Harlow, welcome to Harlow." And then as they're driving off, the black guy, I don't remember any of their names, says, "Woo, welcome to Harlow." And I just thought, like, Harlow is not Haddonfield. This is not a name that's on the tip of everybody's tongue. It's not an iconic locale in horror history. It's this podunk backwater. The whole point of the original movie, a point of the original movie is that going off the grid, here there be monsters kind of feeling, which is evoked so much more successfully in that original movie. I mean, you get the tension of the city slickers who stop at a rural gas station and are a little grossed out and feel like they're out of their element. All of that is present in the original movie without the totally fucking asinine culture clash stuff with the open carry dude and the rest of it, the sheriff and his deputy and all that. They try to make explicit what was present in the original movie in such a way that it just does feel like it was written and directed and conceived of by a Jordan Peele teratoma. I mean, someone who is like the mere opposite evil inversion of Jordan Peele, like different, the same propensity for social commentary, but absolutely no aptitude for it, and totally topsy-turvy politics, or just kind of just inscrutable politics. There's no clarity, but to the extent that there is anything clearly coming through, it's kind of just retrograde and grotesque. And Evil Dies Tonight, man. I don't know.
Leatherface Dies Tonight, or My Name Isn't Sally Dennis Hopper Hardesty.
I wish that the fucking legacy character they brought back had been Dennis Hopper's niece or something. She acts more like him, you know, unhinged.
Yeah, she's much more like Lefty than quote-unquote herself.
Yeah. I'm more like Lefty than whatever I used to be. I feel like I'm frothing at the mouth. The fucking feds don't come and collect me. The men in white coats will have to. I've got more, but I'm going to make a conscious decision to just let it go. Let that chainsaw chain just wind down.
It's not unprecedented. We have done bonus episodes where we say more things.
I gotta seal this fucker up tight. I gotta bottle it and bury it somewhere deep and dark inside of me and never let that genie out of the bottle again, because it really is just a black hole of a thing. I thoroughly hated it. No shit.
Well, speaking of Lefty, my recommendation is that you watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. And in particular, as a palate cleanser, if you've just watched this piece of shit, you could do a lot worse than watching Part 2. Because as Matt said, it is just a deliberately goofy, kind of bad spoof of itself and of the original.
Yeah, there's one good scare in it that got a jump out of me, where Leatherface, in the middle of a conversation, and it's not a calm conversation, but the heroine of that film is being menaced by a new character, the guy with the plate in his head.
Yeah.
But they're just having this kind of tete-a-tete, and then in the middle of their verbal confrontation, which has yet to escalate into violence, Leatherface just lunges out of a dark room in the background, totally apropos of nothing. And as much as I heap praise on the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I don't think, you know, I like Poltergeist, I like some other Tobe Hooper flicks, I like Life Force, which is goofy as hell.
Yes.
But I don't think, outside of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, he didn't do anything to put him in, like, my pantheon or anything. But that moment in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 really woke me up and reminded me, like, oh no, this guy actually knows what he's doing. Later on, there's a guy who's, like, skinned alive, and you think he's dead, and then you realize he's not. And that was also kind of horrifying. And it's a little Three Stoogey, because everything in that first sequel is a little Three Stoogey, but it's also genuinely sickening. And so there's just moments in that movie where he kind of keeps you from relaxing in a way that I found sort of stimulating. And then, you know, Dennis Hopper will show up and go like, dual wielding chainsaws.
Yeah. Speaking of unhinged Texas Rangers, that is the character he plays.
And then it's like slipping into a bubble bath, and you go like, oh, okay, don't scare me like that again, Toby. Just, you know, just let me enjoy this weird spoof.
Let me just watch Lefty and Right,
yeah,
dual wield chainsaws and go ape shit. So yeah, and obviously, this should go without saying, the original is where it's at, 100%. Watch that. Watch it again. Watch it a third time. But yeah, I mean, obviously, if you've checked that box as many times as we have, check out number 2.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun.
Right on. I watched, for reasons passing even my understanding, I watched 3 and 4 before getting around to 2. And I think 2 is... I think 2 is the best sequel. My favorite. Mm-hmm. Anyway, 3 and 4 have their moments. 4 in particular. 4 I'm going to formally recommend because, as I said before, it's kind of Kim Henkel's baby, if memory serves. And it ends with a totally ludicrous, like, meta third act twist that reminded me of Martyrs, actually. You know how, like, the cultists in Martyrs are trying to torture people to achieve enlightenment?
Right.
In Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, which stars, legendarily, Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger, pre-fame, just barely, in both of their cases.
Well, I think, okay, did it come out in 93?
I think you're right. I think it was shelved for a year or two and then came out and marketed itself as...
It came out like after he was in Dazed and Confused,
at the very least, yeah.
But yeah, Zellweger may still not have been in anything huge at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
It ends with this really bizarre turn of events where Renee Zellweger is rescued by these corporate guys, by these suits who have orchestrated all of this. And I think they're supposed to be like studio execs, like, and that's what makes it meta. At least that's the vibe I got. But they also talk in a Martyrs-y fashion about how it was like, it's almost more like Cabin in the Woods, but more than a decade beforehand. Actually, just shy of a decade beforehand. Christ, Cabin in the Woods came out kind of a long time ago.
Well, decade and a half.
Decade, yeah. Jesus.
A decade ago now.
I mean, less time separates Texas Chainsaw Massacre Next Generation from Cabin in the Woods than Cabin in the Woods from the present.
No.
No?
No, because...
Isn't it?
Cabin in the Woods was 2012.
Oh, I was stuck on, you know, fucking Y2K. No one can figure that shit out. At least I can't. Yeah, so, right. Texas Chainsaw Massacre Next Generation has to be seen to be believed, but in kind of an enjoyable way. If nothing else, you've got Matthew Mahogany, you know, acting like...
Matthew Mahogany?
just like...
That's a new one.
Doing everything short of flinging his shit at the screen to get a reaction. Just totally, totally hamming it up, which is pretty fun. In addition to that, I'm going to recommend that you watch Things 5 Strange Monsters. Just in the spirit of really... consigning TCM 22 to the ash heap. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that almost any movie will bring more light into your life than this movie will, including Things 5 Strange Monsters. So have at it. Let me know what you think.
Well, in the meantime, Matt and I are gonna sail away.
Yes.
in the sunroof of an autopiloted Tesla.
I should have just opened this review cackling like Sally at the end of the original, having escaped from the mouth of madness.
From Mr. Blue Garcia.
Yeah. Who hired that clown? That's what I want to know.
Fucking A. Until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese, I guess.
We may or may not be the Shock Doctors, and we hope we'll see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Texas Chainsaw Massacre official trailer Netflix, uploaded by Netflix. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, March 20th, and we will be discussing the period werewolf film The Cursed. See you then.